Welcome to the last Wednesday of the week, the multi-tool of sports podcasts, where we bring you a meaty middle peppered with our highlights of the week in sport. On this week's show, Ben, Simon and myself get stuck into all things Saudi Arabia with headlines made by Formula One over the weekend, not necessarily for the right reasons. We ask many questions of the various sports that go in and out of the country. So join me, Dan, with Simon and Ben on this, the last Wednesday of the week. Good evening, gentlemen. I don't know why I say good evening. It kind of times it, doesn't it? Maybe it's okay. Maybe it doesn't matter. Good evening. I've gone with it. We're in. Locked in. Simon, hello.
Hi, Dan. I'm just excited to be on here. I've just found out Ollie Watkins has just scored his first goal for England. I've had a lovely day with my wife. Oh my God, I've forgotten her name. Dan, help me out. What's her name?
You seem to have a certain pep to yourself today, Si.
Yeah. Dan, what's her name? Please tell me.
Oh, is there a joke coming here?
There's a joke.
Oh, okay. Her name is Sasha.
Keep my wife's name out of your fucking mouth.
There
we go. We got that joke out of the way, so we don't need to bother.
That's fantastic. Do you know what's interesting, though, is it's not even hard to tie the Will Smith, Chris Rock fiasco to sport. Because obviously he was there winning his Oscar for King Richard, who is based on the life of Richard Williams, raising Serena and Venus to be world domination, to dominate the world of tennis, of course. Yeah, super interesting. Do we talk about that on a sports show then, Dan?
But Chris Rock did also make the joke that it's not often you get punched by Muhammad Ali and come away unscathed.
Wow.
And he was in The Longest Yard, which was a remake of the original Longest Yard.
However, I'm agreed with most of the internet, which is Chris Rock missed the obvious opportunity, which was to come back from the ad break on his phone and go, "Yeah, Mum, I'm fine. Sorry, my mum got scared. Now I'm moving with my auntie and uncle in Bel Air."
I mean, Chris Rock didn't even host the Oscars. He just came on to deliver an award. It was hosted by some other people. But absolutely fantastic, super interesting news cycle. Isn't it sad that all it takes is two famous actors to knock Ukraine out of the news cycle?
Yeah, that's quite bonkers, isn't it, actually? And yeah, I mean, we could go down a rabbit hole with Oscars and what kind of violence they actively and verbally condone to that which they applaud and give Oscars to. But yeah, for another podcast, probably. Let's stick with sport. Ben, give us your highlights. What's been going on the week? You know, we're going to get stuck into Formula One, so you don't necessarily need to talk about that. Because bizarrely, for what probably the only show in, I'm sure, the entire history of this show to come as well, Simon is allowing us to talk about Formula One in the meaty middle on his time.
My purpose. It's
on
all
his dime.
Helps me, Dan, and that's why. Just know that.
So Ben, give us your highlights.
Yeah, obviously, let's talk about sport. Let's move on from the Oscars drama. It's British summertime, guys. The world is getting better, or at least in the UK shores. We're starting to see some beautiful things going on, and the world of sport is never ending. I'm going to start actually this evening with Ten Hag, the man himself. I like talking about Manchester United on this show. They're arguably the biggest football club in the world. Let's get that real. So it's always worth talking about the Manchester club. Erik ten Hag is in talks to become their next permanent manager in this summer, taking over from interim manager Ralph Rangnick if he ever gets back from the cricket in Barbados. Ten Hag currently manages Ajax. Let me say, okay, he does a great job at Ajax. Yes, the Dutch league is not the most hard-fought. And we spoke at the beginning or before the show about Rangers and the job Steven Gerrard's doing. It's a similar kind of situation. If I'm honest, one of us could probably get Ajax into the top four in Dutch football. But let's be clear, his teams play excellent football. They bring a lot of young talent through. He seems to be a good fit. I kind of like the way he holds himself. They're a fun team to watch. Although Louis van Gaal, who was United manager way back 2016, I think he got fired, said he doesn't think United are a good fit for Ten Hag and that he should go to a football club, not a, I quote, commercial club. That's savage. I mean, this is literally, this is not big news. It's kind of, you know, United fans look around. That's huge. United are a commercial behemoth. All the fans know they are. Winning on the pitch, for whatever reason, is not exactly needed for Manchester United. The money rolls in, Si.
Yes, it does. And if I was Ten Hag, I would have second thoughts if I was him. It is not only a commercial club, which I can understand. I mean, yes, they do spend a lot of money on players to play on the pitch, such as quality, you know, additions such as Maguire, who's just been on fire this season. but also, it's the graveyard of managers. I mean, how many Man United managers, and yes, you could argue that that's the top and therefore you can't get much higher, but how many of these guys have gone on to as good or better things after United? They've all ended up effectively, you know, many, many, many millions of pounds better off, but reputation-wise, worse off. I mean, Van Gaal, I mean, he's probably had a massive job that I'm just not seeing, but I don't think he's done so much after he left, nothing of particular note. And, you know, David Moyes has managed to carve out a living and, you know, is finally really rescuing his reputation since his time at West Ham. But it was, you know, it was a dark road for him after United. And, you know, I think if I was a manager, yes, you get the money, you get to work with some of the best players in the world. But there are massive problems there. The culture's wrong. The standards are wrong. The aims and objectives are wrong. If I was a really, really good manager and I backed myself, I would probably pick somewhere else to go.
Yeah, I actually echo that. The culture seems to be a bit toxic at Manchester United. Are you saying, though, that the United manager managing the biggest football club in the world is a kind of poisoned chalice?
I think if we were going to use old analogies, I would say, yes, it is a poisoned chalice. I would probably say that... Yeah, it is one of those things that you may win a couple of trophies, you may make a shiteload of money, but in the long run, it probably doesn't do your health much good and it probably doesn't do your reputation much good.
Yeah, I mean, with regards to Manchester United, I think they would do very well getting Ten Hag. Looking from the club's point of view, Ajax are wonderful in possession. That'd be a really good attribute for a quite frankly poor Man United side. The best two sides in English football are currently beautiful in possession, so I think it does work in the English league. But obviously on the advice of Van Gaal and yourself, Si, he may not take the job.
Have a word.
Advisor to the big and powerful within the Premier League on this very show. Ben, let's move on to tennis. You know,
I love tennis.
You haven't spoke about it for about 10 minutes.
I love this stuff.
What's happening? Some good news for the Brits, it seems.
Yeah, get ready till Serve to Survive comes out. I'm going to be talking about it weekly, as I do already. Yeah, we've got another Brit at world number one in the tennis ranks. Joe Salisbury is the world top-ranked doubles player alongside his partner, Rajiv Ram. They've been kind of quietly dominating the world of doubles for a while now, picking up a few slams. Some Masters 1000s, some deep runs into the competition. They've got another semi-final, I want to say, coming up in Miami. Tennis is real bright in this country right now. Obviously, we talked about Emma Raducanu, who has been awful this year. But listen, we're not going to... So bad, but we're not going to heat pressure.
She's now a Porsche ambassador.
Yes, I'm not going to heat pressure.
She's done all right.
She's...
Personality of the year.
Rumours are her post-US Open winnings have ticked past 50 million. And it's not even been 6 months. So, listen, well done, Raducanu. But quite frankly, she's not very good at tennis at the moment. Having said that, though, there are people like Iga Swiatek, who's now won 15 straight matches coming through. There's some amazing women coming through on the tour. Which brings me on to a little point I want to add in here. Finally, well done to Joe Salisbury. Hopefully he cracks on. Tennis is bright. Doubles tennis is fantastic to watch at the moment. Crazy rallies, amazing stuff. But another snippet of tennis talk, Stefanos Tsitsipas, you probably both know him. He said women should be playing best of five sets in a Grand Slam. Now, I'm always reluctant, as we should be, to discuss what men think of women's sports. But in this case, I agree with him wholeheartedly. We've discussed it on here before. Women may not be as strong as men physically when it comes to the speed and power of the game, fundamentally testosterone, scientific reasons, but there's no doubt that women possess a level of stamina that can rival, if not exceed, their male counterparts. I'm pretty sure every ultra running record is owned by women past like 40-mile distance. I don't think it's an issue physically for women to be playing five sets at Grand Slams. There's only four tournaments, for God's sake, anyway. But Naomi Osaka's replied to this. She said, Tsitsipas, he's a funny guy. Does he want to play nine sets? If he tries to extend mine, I'm going to extend his. And I sort of like, I'm reading this thinking, Naomi, like, that's the natural evolution for women's tennis, is to go to five sets at the slams. That's the men only play five sets at the slams. Men play three sets all year round. It's not just men's and women. It's just, for whatever reason, those four slams do not want to extend it to five sets, Dan.
Now, is Naomi an outlier here? But you started that by saying we don't want to form a male opinion on a women's sport, but ended it with Naomi's crazy, it should be five. Is she the outlier, or is the sentiment among the other elite players similar?
She's absolutely right in her sentiment that Stefanos talking about, he's got no right talking about the women's game, but it wasn't spoken about in a kind of misogynistic way. It was basically the natural evolution for women's tennis is five sets at the slams. Surely we all know that. Why aren't they playing five sets? I don't understand it. Naomi said that it would change the training regimen, it would change the focus. Well, yeah, that's okay, though. I don't quite understand this situation. I think it's natural evolution. The issue being is the host venues of the four yearly slams would be clearly reluctant to do it, for the simple reason that it would be a scheduling nightmare. The system works now. Grand Slams get finished on a Sunday. The chances are we'd have some real late nights into the mix. You'd have Wimbledon finishing on a Tuesday, but change it around. I'm all for women tennis going to five sets for one reason, because it's absolutely amazing. So why star fans of only having three sets at the slams? Play for five.
Maybe they should rotate the final as well. The men's one year on the Sunday, the women's the other year on the Sunday.
Oh, absolutely. We spoke about that last time.
Sorry, I know you want to come in.
That's all right. That's all right. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really have a dog in the fight particularly, but would it potentially change the opinion of women's tennis amongst kind of the older guard, the old generic kind of version that, you know, they are inferior athletes in some way or another? Maybe I'm just, you know, spitballing here, but would this, you know, this change to a five set? Because as you said, what's the scientific reasoning behind it? I'm guessing it probably goes back historically to, oh, well, women are inferior to men, so they can only play three sets. So would this allow, that kind of old-fashioned, misogynistic, you know, personality trait or opinion to be eradicated in the modern world?
Yeah, I think the only reason they don't play five sets at the slams, again, we're only talking four tournaments over the course of the year, is because of, you know, sort of archaic rules. I don't even see why they wouldn't. Women's tennis, women get paid as much as men. There aren't as many tournaments for women, mm-hmm. So that is kind of a fleeting statement. But at the slams, those four tournaments, women actually get paid more per set than men do. That's not an issue. And women's tennis is in an incredible place at the moment. Obviously, we lost Ash Barty to retirement. Unbelievable. I don't know if that happened since
last week's show. Well, retirement from tennis.
It happened since last week's show. Is that right?
That's true, yes. Yeah.
Wow, as if that wasn't our starting news. Ash Barty, world number one in tennis, has retired. How did you let me start with Joe Salisbury is current world number one in doubles ahead of Ash Barty retirement, Dan?
Well, you know, I'd give you the opportunity, Ben, but I can show you the door, but you've got to walk through it.
Oh, my God. I've just absolutely made a right call.
The question begs
is,
what sport is she going to go and dominate next?
She's unbelievable. Yeah, she's talented, an ambassador for sport. What an absolute pleasure. She can do whatever she wants. Yeah. We've seen Kim Clijsters. We've seen Henan Arden. Justine Henan, before she was married, come back 26, 27. They retired a similar age, came back. I think Clijsters went on to win two or three slams after. Justine Henin, I don't think, did. But yeah, I'm not suggesting Ash Barty's gone for good or is going to retire. I don't know, but rumours are cricket is her future. But anyway, This is what Tsitsipas is saying. Naomi Osaka has you know, riposted with, I don't want to train that hard. I think they should play to five sets because, quite frankly, women's tennis is amazing. I want to see more of it in the slams. You know, you imagine the Fernandez-Raducanu match. That would have gone to five. That would have gone to five sets.
And everyone would have been up there watching it.
And we all would have been watching it. We probably would have lost a couple of years on our life. No idea where it would have gone. But tell me, after three sets, you didn't want two more. We all did. Yeah. So that's the argument, plain and simple.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Thank you, Ben. So you mentioned Serve to Survive, or whatever it ends up being called, earlier on. Of course, an Amazon production, and we talked really early on in our podcasting journey with last Wednesday of the week about BT Sport, and of course the stalwart of British sports broadcasting, Sky Sports. We have a bit of a messy relationship with, don't we? I'd say it's fair to say the domination has caused problems, not least the cost and the variety of places where everything is, but things are kind of scattergunning everywhere. However, despite that, Ben, there are still some absolute mega personalities on Sky Sports, some of which would probably draw you there by themselves, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Sky Sports have one of the great presenters, sporting presenters, that is, perhaps in the history of broadcast, is probably fair to say. Jeff Stelling, it was 5 months ago, I told you both that Jeff Stelling was stepping down as host of Sky Sports News' flagship. And one of Sky's flagship shows, really, alongside now Monday Night Football, is that Soccer Saturday. He turns out he's pulled a Brady. He's committed to more...
That's a thing now.
He's committed to more years, stating, I was not ready to leave the best job in the world. The rumours were...
Ka-ching.
Well, now, I'm not going to speculate...
What's that sound? Sounds is calling me.
But I'm not going to speculate for at least 2 minutes, and then I'm definitely going to speculate. The rumours were Mark Chapman was in line to take his role. Ooh. Who is going to be pissed. I mean, that was the role of a lifetime, Si.
Yeah, I like the fact that you compare Jeff Stelling sitting down on a Saturday morning into the early afternoon to Tom Brady having his face driven into the ground by some 300-pound D lineman. So, yeah, what was the do we know the real reason that he decided to come back? Is he just being offered more money, do you reckon? Because it seemed like he was slightly put out by the change of the show. I mean, let's be perfectly honest, it's not the show it used to be, because they changed out a lot of the old guard out and brought in people that A, weren't as good, and B, didn't have the personality. So you're saying effectively that money has been the great leveler in the situation, I guess.
Well, listen, it's not been reported that money is the great leveler. And yeah, we'll discuss it, but let me just give you a sort of rundown, you know, listeners, a rundown of the show. A lot of people would have watched it, but Soccer Saturday is kind of a fairly odd television show. Obviously, Jeff Stelling's the main actor. He's joined by a panel of former football players. Those four are watching television screens that the viewer can't see, and they all bark out scores and describe the goals that they then aren't able to show the viewer.
OG reaction video from YouTube.
Yes, it works. It's entertaining. It's a truly brilliant TV model for whatever reason. I can't quite understand it, but I've watched this show from 12 till 5 a few Saturdays in my life. You know, I don't watch it regularly now, I'll be honest with you, but I used to really enjoy it. Jeff himself, he joined Sky in 1994, then became the Soccer Saturday host in 98. That's a long time in any job, for God's sake. And he's a large reason, I think a large part of the reason why the show is successful. No doubt about that. The view that everyone is replaceable in life, I think is true, except for Simon, obviously, on this week. But it would be really hard to replace Jeff Stelling. I do believe it'd be hard to replace him.
Ben,
Dan,
can you name one fictional character that has appeared with him on that panel?
No.
Simon?
Blobby. No. Oh,
it wasn't Blobby.
Mr. Blobby.
Yeah, Mr. Blobby. Yes. Was it House of Fun? Noel Edmonds' House of Fun.
It wasn't him. No. Simon feels like he might have it on the tip of his tongue.
I'm going to get very sad. Go on, tell us.
It was Roy Kent.
Oh, of course it was Roy Kent.
of Ted Lasso fame.
Okay.
I thought he was real. I thought that was a documentary.
It was actually Roy Kent of Ted Lasso. But it is a documentary now. I mean, Jesse Marsh at Leeds is living the Ted Lasso life. And we should mention it every week. Obviously, Jeff Stelling, you'd think, you know, that job, he loves his job. Now, obviously, he's coming back for another season. Why would he ever have thought about leaving it? The first kicker we spoke, obviously, about was when Sky controversially sacked the three main pundits. Letitier Le God, as he's known where I am right now. I'm literally less than a kilometre away from his stomping ground at St Mary's. Phil Thompson and Charlie Nicholls. He considered quitting, but he stayed on to what he kind of referred to as ushering in the new generation. So obviously, you know, there's change. The idea was simply that Sky Sports Soccer Saturday needed more representation. It is hard to argue. There must be representation in sporting media in the modern day. It is more important than any one presenter. I really do believe that. But the show worked. There's no question it worked. And I for one will say it was maybe dangerous to mess with a proven model in terms of viewership. But listen, I mean, you have to have representation. It's 2022, for God's sake. So we have to roll with the punches, perhaps. Now, I'm going to obviously refer to what you guys said at the beginning. Let's talk about money. It is understood why the reason he came back. He said he was not prepared.
That's not a word. It's a good word.
He said he was prepared to leave the best. He was not prepared to leave the best job in the world.
You could have gone with not known. We don't know.
Ununderstood.
You went with ununderstood.
Right. I'm coining the phrase ununderstood.
You're shellacking the English language tonight.
He is getting paid. I've done a little bit of internet sleuthing before tonight's show. He's getting paid a handsome £32,000 per month. This, I believe, has been substantially added to. Whether it's been up to the regions of seven figures per year, it's hard to find the information, but Sky Sports know how much they need him. The chances are he probably has. A quick one on that, the £32,000 per month. The sad realization is that when I say a figure like that, most people go, oh, okay. Actually, that's an insane amount of money, okay? It is not in the realm of footballer money.
Do you know what? After tax and pension and, you know, his student loan payment, it's going to be like a tenner.
Yeah, how does he get by?
With his national insurance increase, you know.
Yeah. But listen, for a presenter journalist, put it this way, there are not many journalists in the country getting paid anywhere near that. It is unbelievable.
Gary Lineker?
It's a big Gary Neville and Carragher.
Hmm.
100%, 100% they will be, yeah. Very, very, I mean, that...
Gary Lineker, definitely.
Gary Lineker is getting paid 10 times what Jeff Stelling is getting paid. But for whatever reason, Gary Lineker seems to be just this... he's loved by the UK and he's... I think his Twitter followers now is one of his big sources of income. Anyway, it's a big play for both Jeff and Sky. Obviously, he's continuing. Sky Sports needs to compete with the content providers, the huge content providers that we look to. Sky Sports, I'm going to give you a couple of facts before we just roll past. Sky Sports currently have 13 million UK subscribers. In 2013, that was only 3.3 million. That's a staggering increase. Sky Sports are currently making £2 billion profit per year, have been doing more or less for the last 3 years. So yeah, Sky have 13 million UK subscribers. Sigh, how many do you reckon Netflix have?
In the UK?
In the UK, yeah. And Dan, you dive
16
in.
million.
Interesting. Very close. 14 million. So actually, it's insane how close. Sky have more or less the same subscribers as Netflix, for God's sake.
Granted, Netflix are going to cost the same much as Sky soon. They're just putting their prices up again.
Yeah, Netflix obviously putting the price up, but they're also rumour have it taking away the additional account on one account, putting it down to
that,
one.
That's like one of those perennial rumours that comes up.
Yeah, and it will eventually be done. Netflix, by the way, worldwide, 250 million. Amazon UK, 12.3 million. So Sky have more subscribers than Amazon in the UK. But again, Amazon worldwide, 250 million. And Disney are just nearing 5 million UK. So listen, Sky Sports are unbelievable. They're in a great position. Jeff's selling back for another season of Soccer Saturday. He's important. He's kind of the flagship Saturday content. And it will do well for both. But yeah, I think his pockets have been deepened.
Well, fair enough, you know, fair enough to him. You know, why not if he still can? But like you say, Ben, maybe it is time for fresh faces. But yeah, who knows what will happen in the future. Right, thank you very much, Ben. Si, let's move over to you. Let's start with Kyrie Irving. We haven't talked about NBA for a little while.
We haven't, Ben. I thought I was going to have a non-US based sports like highlights package, and then I've realised that they all are a US based sport. So forgive me, I'm coming across as Mr. American sports guy again. But yeah, Kyrie Irving. So I talked about him for a while. I mean, he's been a bit of a controversial figure within the NBA. Well, for years, flat earther, anti-vaxxer, etc., etc. But his opinion on the latter, on anti-vax and being anti-vax, basically for COVID, obviously not BCG, or maybe that as well, has effectively meant that he couldn't play within his home state. So he's a member of the Brooklyn Nets. He's the point guard for the Brooklyn Nets, but he couldn't play for them all year because New York State has a vaccine mandate that you cannot play within that state without a vaccine. So effectively, well, he kind of went on strike. He basically didn't get a game check for those games, but he played the away games. So went to any other state that had less stringent laws on the vaccine, and he played. But now New York has finally lifted their vaccine mandate, and he came and played his first game in a long time at the Barclays at the Barclays Center, and they lost. So his triumphant return to a New York basketball court ended in failure. Brooklyn Nets, biggest super team, really, really famous super team in the NBA, are currently on the verge of possibly missing the playoffs. So an interesting situation there. We are coming down to the final of the final stretch of games, about 10 games left. And sadly, New York Knicks beat my beloved Chicago Bulls last night. So
yeah, we're on a run of four, Si.
Yeah, I know.
Against your lost streak of one.
Yeah, we are just playing absolutely dreadfully right now and trying our best to try and not make it to the playoffs. But yeah, it's sort of interesting to kind of go back to a previous story on Kyrie Irving, a well-known anti-vaxxer who is, well, I suppose, got his way in that he was never vaccinated, but he hasn't played for such a long time and his team is on the verge of missing the playoffs effectively. So interesting situation. And the playoffs are looking really juicy in the NBA this year.
Now, I understood and read something, I think it was on Twitter, that he said, I quote, "I wish we had a day of rest," talking about, you know, the schedule coming up. And I think he's had some harsh remarks, considering I think he missed a large part of the beginning of the season with injury. You know, and it's hard when these multimillionaires say, "I wish we had a day of rest." I read the Boston Celtics are doing very well.
They have completely turned it around. They started off the year, Coach Stevens, their coach, is now their general manager, and it was seen as a bit of a strange move at the time, but he is, effectively brought in some players, and their new coach, whose name escapes me, started off really rocky, really, really bad. They were, you know, borderline, you know, outside the playoff picture, and now they've just been on absolute gangbusters, and they are solidly entrenched. And at one point, were top of the East. So yeah, they've really, really turned it around. But that Eastern Conference is very, very tight right now. So there are four teams going for the number one spot in the East. So, and then the Celtics are one of them. And as I said, when you saw their start to the year, you couldn't have seen that coming, but they've really, really turned it around.
Nice. Well, always been a Celtics fan. Celtics.
Me too. Yeah.
All right. Let's move from the National Basketball Association to the National Football League. Your other true love in life, Simon. Overtime rules changing?
Ooh, I like the fact you've done this.
I don't even know what the rules were.
Oh, so I think we may have talked about it. So you've missed the Canadian football team. So I'm guessing that's going to be your last. I like the way you've done that. You've moved that around. Kept me on my toes. The overtime rules in the NFL. We talked about it at the end of last year. We talked about it when the Buffalo Bills played the Kansas City Chiefs, and it was possibly one of the greatest games of all time that ended with a bit of a damp squib when, with the current overtime rules, it was basically sudden death touchdown scoring. So the Chiefs won the coin toss. They promptly went down the field and scored a touchdown to win. So Josh Allen.
So sudden death is where after the touchdown zone, the floor dropped away to like a 100-foot drop. So if they went too far, they'd just fall to their deaths.
Dan, you told me you never watched it. I think you've just proven
honestly,
you have.
There are things that would make me watch it.
And they have barbed wire around that section and then fireworks, but they're actually just like these oh, no, that's wrestling. Yeah.
I think you're talking about the XFL.
Exploding barbed wire deathmatch.
Oh, yeah. The Bills
Can I just say, I don't want to see anyone die.
There just could be derailed my entire...
Those just kind maimed. Of blow-up things at the bottom, you know, that they'd stun people jump onto. But that's what NFL needs. It needs more excitement.
Right.
It needs more stunt people.
We're talking about a man who watches cars drive around a track for 80 laps. 80 fucking laps.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
We will talk about that, Dan, because of you know, being the alpha, I'm allowing you to talk about it.
Oh, dude. This is basically what Will Smith thought before he went on and smacked the crap out.
Dan's about to get up and give
me a good old slap. Simon.
Toxic masculinity.
We can't hear Simon, can we? Because he's muted. Someone must have muted him.
You can't, Dan.
There's a power play.
Damn, these games only work in like when you watch your TV, because if we mute him, we literally don't hear him.
Yeah.
So the viewer doesn't hit, the listener outrageous. Doesn't
hear. It's not toxic, by the way, baby. It's just masculinity.
Okay.
So anyway, before Dan so rudely interrupted with talk of explosions and fun, the Bills quarterback, Josh Allen, never got a chance to riposte the Kansas City Chiefs touchdown, and a game ended in a bit of a damp squib. So just after the Super Bowl, the teams got together and they've agreed today to change it. So there will now be, if you score a touchdown, the other team will still get a chance to go back the other way and score a touchdown, and then it becomes sudden death. So it just increases the fairness a little bit. An interesting turn of events, and it's only for the postseason, so we will avoid anything in the future like we did last season.
I think it's fair, Si, let's be honest, because Josh Allen played a good game. The Bills played a good game. They probably deserved to win the match, I'll be honest. I think it was unfair on a coin toss. The Bills could very well have gone on and won the Super Bowl. So that rule could well have cost Allen and co. I'm pro that rule changing. Give the opposition a chance to at least... go down and restore parity. Not necessarily, they'll definitely score. You might see turnovers and this kind of thing. Mm. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Very much, I'm already looking forward to the playoffs. Like, I don't even know who's going to be there. And that's ages away. I mean, literally January. Is that right? Amazing. Can't wait. NFL's amazing, right?
And I don't think that the Bears or the Patriots will probably be there, sad as that sounds. But that's a topic for another day.
No, neither shall.
All right, so let's move further north. Tell us about Canada. We don't talk about Canada a lot.
Yes, so home of hockey, Tim Hortons, Grizzly Bears, other things, Mounties.
Poutine.
also home of the newly qualified Canadian football team. So football club, their international football team. I'm not talking about American football. I'm not talking about Canadian football with the Grey Cup here and your Toronto Argonauts. I'm talking about proper round ball football here. They have made their first World Cup since 1986. They beat Jamaica at the weekend 4-0 to qualify. And yeah, what an awesome achievement. And we're going to have, surreally, a Canadian team at the Qatar World Cup. So being the only one of us who will be able to watch it, because Ben will refuse and Dan will, I don't know. Well, Dan, you tend to watch the big tournaments a bit, so I think you'll come around. But we've got to work on Ben a little bit, you know, to cheer on that Canadian team if they're not playing the English.
So one of the issues that has been talked about, I mean, not the issue of being in Qatar, but one of the issues for players is around the temperatures. Perhaps naively asking, is that a massive, I mean, obviously just getting there is probably a massive thing for them, and they'll take anything going forward. But are the Canadian players from around, you know, do they play around the world, or are they going to have some of the more extreme temperature adjustments to make?
But that's the reason it was moved to winter, Dan. So you're not necessarily, it's still going to be hot, but I mean, you know, Canadian summers can be hot. Yeah, I don't think that's going to be an issue. I mean, if it was in July in Qatar, people would literally be melting on the
pitch. But it's been talked about, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it's still going to be exceedingly warm. I mean, we're probably looking in the 30s for most days, easily.
Yeah, I mean, we're garbage tournament.
But going on, ignoring Ben's slandering of the tournament. Yeah, I mean, most of these guys do play around the world. You've got a few really, really good players. Alfonso Davies being the big jewel of the crown, the left back for Bayern Munich. But you've got Junior Hoylett, formerly of QPR fame. Jonathan David, who plays for Lille. So yeah, most of these guys play in Europe, most of the good ones anyway. I had a little look at a few of the other players, and they play, you know, second division German football and stuff. So there's always an understanding in teams without, in countries without competitive leagues, that you've got to go abroad. And even most of the American team now play abroad, because it's the best chance to get, you know, to a certain level that you really can't afford in the MLS. Although the MLS is improving slowly but surely, but it's still not there yet.
Can I ask, because we just brushed over, Si said the Toronto Argonauts. Is there an actual Canadian-American football team called the Toronto Argonauts?
There is. Yeah, there's
that's an amazing team. Instant fan.
Saskatchewan Rough Riders, the BC Lions. Yeah, there's a whole Grey Cup. It's Canadian football. The Rock of wrestling and now substandard movie fame he played Canadian football for a brief period of time. So yeah, it was basically for failed NFL.
Always been a
NFL
fan of Canadian football
players. Yeah. And play three downs instead of four downs, but there's a massive end zone. It's a little bit odd, but the rules are similar-ish. You could probably follow it, but yeah, the standard's not quite as good. But yeah, there's I think seven Canadian teams, the Montreal Alouettes. You know, I'm just spitballing here. But yeah, there's
all right, guys.
Ottawa Red Blacks.
We're not done, Dan. I'd want to talk about the Argonauts. Imagine if they had a quarterback called Jason.
Jason, yes.
That's a film reference, Dan.
Bet no one's thought of that.
That's actually a Greek mythology reference, really. But yeah.
Okay.
All right, our brief highlights is knocking on for 40 minutes, so I'm going to call time on that today, because I'm sure we could go all night long, but we're not going to. So if you've got any highlights you want to share with us, want to find out what the boys are talking about on Twitter and otherwise, you can find us at Wednesday Pod and on Instagram at Wednesday Pod as well. Please also do find us on your podcast platform. Like, follow, subscribe, tell your friends, share the word, give us a rating. It helps spread the message of the good ship last Wednesday. Right, let's move on to our probably less meaty middle. Ben, Simon, we're going to talk about Saudi Arabia. And it made headlines at the weekend. Formula One, unusually making headlines. It doesn't often make the big headlines. But it did, because on Saturday, there was a missile strike of an Aramco oil depot just 7 miles from the Jeddah street circuit. And the drivers on Saturday night spent... No, sorry, this was Friday. So the drivers on Friday night spent, I think it was about 4 hours in the driver's room trying to debate whether they want to race or not. There were drivers before and against, by all accounts. At some point, all the team principals came in. Then they all left. The big bosses of Formula One, Stefano Domenicali, Ross Brawn, they came in. They left. And at the end of the night, about 2:30 a.m., I think, local time to them, the decision was that they will continue racing despite the threat of further attacks or whatever else. So very tired drivers went on to compete the race, and the race went ahead as normal. But, you know, following on from the conversation we started last week around morals in sports and big money, it's not lost on anyone that's following Formula One that Aramco, the depot that was targeted, the Saudi oil company, is one of the biggest sponsors of Formula One. It's a very hard thing to untangle yourself from these big sponsorships when you rely on them to exist. So it the cynical people amongst us would have never ever had hope that they might then choose not to race regardless of what the drivers wanted. So that sort of sets the scene as to why it hit the news. Simon, I know you've got much more you want to dive into across the board, I'm going to leave it there actually and hand over to you.
Oh, really, Dan? I thought we were going to have a whole synopsis of the race. I was dug in. I was prepared for a lengthy, as I said, synopsis of the goings on. Who won, Dan? Come on,
yeah,
tell me.
Dan, let's at least give a rundown. Okay, because I didn't watch the race. Obviously, I've said on previous episodes I don't watch the race. I know who won through yourself. So what happened in the race? What was it, good? Was it bad? What happened?
Well, it's worth noting that this is not a comfortable track to watch drivers race round. It's argued it's a dangerous track. Some of the drivers love it. Some of the drivers really like it. Some of the drivers don't like it. It's not a pleasant, it's not a comfortable viewing experience. And I think that's compounded by the tensions around racing in Saudi Arabia and some of the questions around that. But also, you know, some of the tensions raised by the missile strike on the weekend as well. But there was also a fairly big shunt for Mick Schumacher, who hit the wall and was extricated from the car, taken to the hospital. He's absolutely fine, you know, Instagrammed later on that day, but massive, massive shunt. And these are many, many blind corners where they're coming around at like 150 miles an hour, not seeing cars that could be stopped in the middle of the road. So there's lots of risks there, very close to the wall. And brand new track. They could have built anything. They literally could have built anything. It was brand new, but that's what they went with. That's what we've got. And we're going to be there for some time. There's no way we're going to stop racing there. But yeah, Max Verstappen went on to win the race after another dominating performance from Ferrari, after Perez put it on pole on Saturday as well. So Ferrari and Red Bull really out the gates, the strong two, with Mercedes a little bit chasing their tails and following up behind. But yeah, I watched it very much as a background activity. I didn't really get a lot from it. It's an uncomfortable track to watch. I don't particularly enjoy watching it. I didn't last year. I didn't this year. I'm looking forward to Australia.
He wasn't allowed to watch all of it as well because it was Mother's Day.
Well, yeah.
He's a wonderful mother. I think Si, you go first and I shall then perhaps comment later.
Yeah, so kind of moving on, obviously, yeah, Dan so eloquently kind of summarised the issue that happened at the time with the Houthi rebels attacking this oil company. You know, Saudi Arabia, it's a very controversial thing. It's not quite as controversial as Russia, for example, at the moment. And it kind of all ends up that we end up talking about morality in sports and everything like that. But I think there's a couple of interesting things. And Saudi Arabia keeps kind of coming up at the moment. So they were effectively barred from bidding for Roman Abramovich's Chelsea because of, you know, issues with their foreign policy, despite the fact that they already got Newcastle United in the bag. or Roman Abramovich, by the way, who was possibly poisoned quite recently, which is another interesting story that, you know, that kind of stretches to sport, but isn't really sporting, I suppose. But, yeah, you know, we've talked about the 81 executions the other week. There's the war in Yemen, you know, destabilizing the region, as kind of proven by the attacks. Their restrictions on women, their restrictions and their abhorrent behavior to the LGBTQ plus community, which I suppose is very, very similar in some ways to Qatar. But we kind of discussed that a little bit last week. Kind of going on what we said about F1. So the other week, and I forgot to mention this, Stefano Domenicali, I believe is
Domenicali.
That one, yeah. He was actually quizzed about whether, and this is interesting, for the eye of all people managed to see a clip on F1. He was quizzed about racing in Saudi Arabia. And he said, by racing there, we're actually shedding light on the issues there. Now, obviously, in an ironic way, it was kind of an ironic foreshadowing because they ended up with a massive attack on a local oil refinery. But at the same point, is that more just an attempt to validate the fact that they're making a shit ton of money and, as you said, are sponsored by many Saudi-based companies? Yes, Daniel.
So it's worth pointing out at this point that Sky Sports, of course, make a lot of money out of Formula One and put a lot of money into Formula One. Their viewing figures for the Saudi Grand Prix was their highest viewing figures for any Formula One race that they have shown in the last 10 years. Now that is staggering. There are many reasons, of course, not least will be the time it was on. It was the mid-evening. There was no other big competing sports events during the day for it to compete against, possibly a factor. So I guess the question begs then is, was Stefano Domenicali potentially right in that there's now a much bigger audience aware of some of the challenges that Saudi Arabia has as a result? I don't know. Maybe that's not a fair question. Maybe it's an irrelevant question. But more people now know what was happening because of that missile attack than they probably did before.
I'd like to see the figures from Friday, Saturday and Sunday, because you said it was obviously the most watched, the Sunday race. Yeah. Was practice the most watched, or were people tuning in Sunday because they were expecting to see live missile strikes on the Jeddah track as cars were racing around? As bad as that sounds, humans are drawn to conflict and drama.
I mean, it's probably a fair question.
You know, and I mean, let's consider the Formula One put their not only their drivers but also their spectators and the Formula One community at risk by going ahead with that race. There was a missile strike a few miles from the track, and that could well have been, you know, at turn 12. I don't know the track very well, but it could very well have been on the track, and it could have killed spectators. Would you want to go watch a race there? I think it's abhorrent that they went ahead with the race, and it shows just the power of money.
Dan, as well, just kind of further on from Ben's very eloquent point there. Did the vote matter? Was it that they voted to go ahead? Was it effectively that they were kind of given the choice and they were kind of persuaded, or is that not common knowledge and we will never know until someone writes an autobiography somewhere?
From what I've read, it's not necessarily widely known. I think it was that a handful of drivers were quite strongly against continuing racing. Some others probably didn't care. Others really wanted to, I'm sure. But certainly optics-wise, it seemed to be a case of team principals, F1 bosses coming in and saying, look, we're racing. Because as Christian Horner walked away, it kind of said to the cameras, we're racing. And the drivers were still in there for like another hour and a half, 2 hours or whatever it was. So, you know, I suspect when it came down to it, there probably wasn't a great deal of choice to the drivers. However, they still need to get on their feet and walk to the grid. So, you know, and You know, that's what they're paid to do. It's what they want to do, racing. Yeah.
Sport is a great communicator, Dan. It's important for countries to host sporting events. It gives a good sort of positive geopolitical message. But obviously we've got this term sports washing coming in now. You know, in Saudi Arabia at the forefront of that. It doesn't matter whether they're a sporting country or not. I don't care about that. I think every country can be and should be a sporting country. Sport should be played everywhere. You know, kids should be able to kick a footy in the street in every continent, everywhere, apart from maybe Antarctica, where it's a bit too cold. But I think, you know, what we saw from Saudi Arabia, saw the missile strikes, and we saw, that's no problem. Let's go ahead. Put it this way, if there was a missile strike 8 miles away from, 7 miles away, whatever it was, from Silverstone, there's no way that Grand Prix would have been going ahead that weekend. So I just want to say...
Many people also thought that if Sebastian Vettel was there,
it wouldn't have gone ahead.
The stand would have been a bit stronger from the drivers.
Yeah,
but
because he's the only one...
conjecture and hypothetical, isn't it? I think to suggest that people were going to Saudi Arabia not knowing what was already happening between that country and other countries in the region and things like that would be, I think, naive and perhaps a bit dishonest. Formula One is clearly very aware of what's going on around the world. We just happened to see it on the TV cameras.
We can't, at no point can British people of us three are condemn a country for the things they've historically done, especially as a Brit. I mean, our history is horrendous, truly horrific, okay? Our country's built on pillaging and pondering and plundering, I should say. Maybe now pondering at political levels, I don't know. But the problem is Saudi Arabia using this sport to cover up current misgivings. And when, you know, we're trying to promote equality and, you know, fairness through sport, and we go to a country where none of that is entertained. I don't know. I mean, you know my views. I didn't watch the race, and I didn't miss anything. Happy for the next race. I don't feel like I'm missing out. I've not got FOMO.
So, I mean, talking about what we're talking about as well, this isn't the only things that they're doing at the moment. They've also there's a great deal of traction. The idea that the Anthony Joshua Usyk rematch will be fought in Saudi Arabia, because of course both of those are very the deep roots to Saudi Arabia, one from the Ukraine and one from wherever he's from in London. You know, we also had talk about Fury and Joshua possibly being in Saudi Arabia, which is even more farcical when you could sell out Wembley Stadium. You know, you've got the Saudi Golf League, which is, it's still kind of going, isn't it? They've just announced eight event tour or whatever it is, where you'll have, you know, a prize money of about $255 million to play for, which is a nice chunk of change. Greg Norman is heading it up, I believe, but no official standard bearers yet as to who's going to be playing it. Ben talked about it briefly. Was it last week? I think we talked about with Mickelson, that no one's kind of come out yet and said, "Oh, I'm breaking away." A lot of the big names in golf are still sticking with the PGA. I know it's difficult because, yeah, I think you've got a point, and I think I'll go further. Are we hypocrites for calling out Saudi Arabia? Granted, our historical, you know, comparing our horrendous historical history that we have as British people to what's currently going on in Saudi Arabia is slightly different, although there are very, very big links between Saudi Arabian arms dealing with the UK and actually buying arms off of us. So technically, I suppose we are playing a slightly dubious part in the whole thing as well. But are we hypocrites, gentlemen? Should we be highlighting these things, or should we just keep our mouth shut? Because, I mean, our Premier League, I mean, these guys aren't coming to the Premier League because they want to live in England. They're coming because they'll get $200,000 a week to play here. So are we just hypocrites?
Yeah, maybe. And maybe as sport fans, we need to just take a step back and say it is what it is. I don't know. I don't actually know where your own kind of morals, you know, and sport intersect. And you just haven't got to stick with your beliefs, I guess. I don't watch the Saudi Arabian race. I don't think we should be racing there. It looks like there'll be discussions about next year's race on safety concerns, at least. You know, and obviously we've talked about the Qatar World Cup itself, but perhaps as sport fans, we should just enjoy the sport. And I believe there was some fantastic racing between Verstappen and Leclerc at the weekend. But I don't know, if countries are using sport to mask really bad things, then yeah, sports should take a stand. But I don't know where that would be. Say, for instance, Saudi Arabian funds came in last Wednesday of the week and said, guys, I'm going to broadcast you on a Saudi Arabian radio channel. We're going to pay you $10 million a year. Would you do it?
Where do I sign?
And there on that note, you've been last Wednesday of the week.
And I'd like to take back all I have said about the glorious nation of Saudi Arabia.
Wonderful, wonderful nation.
It's, it's a really difficult one. I think the only thing we can do is keep talking about it, and dialogue is ever more important. One thing we do know is money speaks. Money is king. Cash is king. Cash is what gets stuff done, and cash is what almost certainly kept the racing happening. It's what will keep the racing coming back to Saudi Arabia. It's what will keep coming back to places that put it on and provide the sponsorship and the deals. And, you know, it greases the wheels, literally. So, until there's a disconnect between that mechanism, I think all we can do is talk about it still, champion what we want to champion: inclusion, diversity, equality, fairness, compassion, kindness, all this stuff. We can espouse it, but we can only affect so much from our standpoint. Si, you've frozen, so it's hard to know if you've got something else to say at this stage.
No, I've just frozen because Saudi Arabian agent of mine is now in contact, and I'm signing up.
Then, all right, so he's Simon's fighting going AJ. The dollar bill, y'all.
I'm fighting AJ, yeah. I'm his tune-up match. I'll do it.
You've probably got cool. A good chance. He's not that good anymore, is he?
He's got a bit of a glass jaw these days, hasn't he? Yeah. A bit like Amir Khan.
But one thing I didn't notice, because I didn't watch any of the race build-up. I only watched on quiet the race in the background at the weekend, is apparently Naomi Schiff was not part of the presenting team this weekend. Now, Naomi Schiff is a Rwandan-Belgian racing driver and ambassador for motor racing. She was part of the... She's now part of the Sky presenting team on the TV show over the weekend. She was fantastic addition to the lineup in Bahrain. I thought her insight, she just brought fresh energy. It was really nice to see her on there. She was not in Saudi Arabia, and I don't know why, but I'm looking forward to seeing more of the coverage. I think Sky have done a great thing there in bringing her on board, and I do hope to see more of her.
Yeah, that. I believe it was Sky's decision.
Interesting.
Take from that what you will.
Yeah, no, I don't know where to go with that, but maybe we'll leave that as an open question, open thought. But I think she's absolutely vital to the Sky's coverage should they wish to continue in a couple of years' time. So
I don't know if I'm frozen or not yet, so I had to write that down to you as a...
Frozen, mate. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Fantastic. That's what happens when you have fantastic internet where I live. So just one other thing as well. I mean, kind of to end maybe on a positive note, maybe there is a little bit of change afoot, as it were, because I don't watch WWE wrestling or anything like that. As you know, I watch a little bit of AEW wrestling, but it's difficult to bring this up on a sports podcast because it blurs the line between what is a sport, what isn't. But they have been doing a lot of deals recently, the WWE with Saudi Arabia. So I wonder why. So it's probably meant that their share prices have bolted up a little bit because they're making shitloads of cash. But when they first went out there, which was quite recently, really, all the women wrestlers were not allowed to wrestle at all. So there was a massive controversy when I think it was either a WrestleMania advert or poster or something was seen on Saudi Arabian TV because it had one of the women wrestlers. It might have been Charlotte Flair or someone like that on the actual poster, and that caused a massive faux pas, as it were. But recently, within the last couple of years anyway, women wrestlers have been able to have matches on the card. They do have to wear full bodysuits, kind of full versions of what they would have normally as their normal wrestling gear. But, you know, maybe we are seeing a more liberal approach to a certain extent. Yes, I mean, it's still with a caveat. It's still with its own, you know, possible rules. But at least maybe there's a softening things. And maybe we will see a time where we don't look at Saudi Arabia as this hardline country and they liberal up a little bit.
I think it's important to adhere to a country's rules. I mean, in terms of covering up, that's fine. That's just adhering to a country. Wow, I nearly said a real bad word then. A country's culture. I'm all in support of that. It's the fact that, you know, you get shot if you're gay. That's the stuff I'm not in support of. And that's the stuff that I think sport is washing over that message. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a minefield. Yeah. I'm just glad that we have Dan here, Mr. Column A, Column B, to lead us through this difficult time.
Well, we will do what three, you know, approaching
white
middle-aged, privileged white male will do and mangle our way through the conversation. But yeah, you can join that conversation tentatively, I might add, on Twitter and Instagram at Wednesday Pod on either. And yeah, you know, these things don't happen overnight. Attitudes and changes and habits and countries don't suddenly stop doing what they've been doing for hundreds of years overnight, as we well know. Right. Thank you very much, Simon, for that tour of Formula One accidentally on your behalf. But we will move on to what are we looking forward to? What's coming up in the week ahead of sport? Benjamin, what have you got?
It's April in 3 days. I am an absolute lover of April in sports. We've got loads coming up. Talked about a little bit last week. Interesting, we didn't talk at the beginning of the show about Gareth Bale, his reaction to his
that is interesting.
Real Madrid
tell us more.
Pay packet, because that was wonderful. Quite frankly, you know, they're calling him a leech over in Spain. And quite frankly, he is one. He just gets paid to sit on the bench. I don't really know how you defend him. But listen, he's got a few Champions Leagues and a massive bank account. I'm not really massively worried for him. And also Ash Barty. I just want to add legend of the game. We're really going to miss her on the tennis court. And I'm sure she'll be winning whatever endeavor she does next. She's just got that winner's mentality. But yeah, 3 days till April, loads of sport. Oh, and also a little thing known as the Premier League comes back this weekend.
We should support that more. A bit of an underdog sports league, isn't it? That?
Yeah, not heard of, not talked about.
Tell me what hasn't been talked about for a little while, our fantasy Premier League.
Well, that's because there's been no Premier League for a little while. But yes, I'm doing very well, Dan, if you should ask.
I got an email from them. They tried to hook me in. Their emails are very clever. The headline just said, "Wow, Dan, you've raised up the rankings." I signed in. I'm like, it's just not true at all.
Well, listen, I am currently sitting 687,013th out of 9 million. So, you know, 10 points to Gryffindor?
Slytherin, definitely Slytherin. Yeah, Slytherin. Si, what's on your radar for the week ahead?
Well, yeah, I mean, Premier League football's back. I look forward to another Aston Villa loss to make it three in a row, so then we can go back on another winning streak. I'd just like to highlight as well, just a time date us a little bit. England won 3-0, just confirmed against Côte d'Ivoire. And two Aston Villa players scored. So Tyrone Mings scored and Ollie Watkins. So, further proof that Villa are the best team in the world. But yeah, same sort of thing. NFL free agency is still limping on a little bit. Not much to kind of discuss at the moment. So hoping for some big ass trades to come through again, which seems to, you know, come up quite regularly. So we'll see. And then it's the NFL draft soon. So I'm really excited about that as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. There's literally nothing on that I'm aware of this weekend that I will probably watch. I'm literally the worst person to host this show. I wonder if anyone's cottoned on yet.
I have been saying it. I've been logging onto different Twitter accounts and sending you messages, but you don't seem to have realised yet.
Well, I have. but yes, that does bring us rather awkwardly to the end of this week's show. We have nothing for you. We have nothing left to give. You've bled us dry with all our sporting joie de vivre of this last Wednesday of the week. So all that's left to say is I've been Dan.
I've been Simon.
And I've been Ben.
Until next last Wednesday of the week, be kind. Bye-bye.
Bye.